Lecture 24, The Eternal Return of Natural Law.
One of the crucial aspects of any understanding of philosophy is to go over again the material that one has covered, and we've now reached that point in this attempt to consider natural law theory. It's our opportunity in this lecture to look at what we have covered and to look ahead to the future, to what else it is that needs to be considered. In our study of natural law in this course, we have tried to investigate some of the general ideas that are true of all kinds of natural law theory. We've looked over the history of natural law to try to understand the various ways in which these insights emerged, not just to appreciate the details of that flow, but to appreciate how difficult it was sometimes to articulate it. And I have little doubt that philosophy of natural law is an ongoing affair, that we still have much to understand about human nature and human society, and so that this kind of thinking can lead us yet to further progress in other areas where it has not yet been applied at all or where there is still disagreement and discussion. When we look in particular at something like modern political theory, we see the ways in which natural law theory has sometimes used different terminology, that the phrases that are so important to the earlier history of natural law, things such as the very term natural law that focus on human nature, has yielded in the course of time to considerations about natural rights, considerations of human dignity. And in these things, the natural law theory still abides. In fact, some of the great books on natural law speak about the eternal return of the natural law. That is, that it's one of those theories which will continue to be rediscovered even when an age has forgotten it, precisely because of the source that natural law theory uses, namely human nature in the various ways in which that human nature manifests itself. What I'd like to do in this final lecture, then, is to concern ourselves with some of those great themes, the central concepts that are true of any natural law theory, the ways in which these central concepts manifest themselves in some of the stronger contenders of genuine natural law, the ways in which the terms are sometimes used or even abused by those surrogates and counterfeits of natural law, and finally, an attempt to review some of the important ways in which this can be applied to practical questions. Central to the long but varied tradition of natural law thinking has been a concern with three primary characteristics of ethical thinking, namely objectivity, universality, and intelligibility. I think that any ethical theory, any of natural law's competitors, utilitarianism, for instance, or divine command ethics, or Kantian duty ethics, has to struggle with some of these same criteria, namely how to make a claim that is objective, something that any reasonable person can see and find grounded and is not just sort of an idea or an opinion, but rather is something that has a root and a strength and is objective, granting that it's difficult to get there. Likewise, there's a concern that any ethical theory worth its salt has with universality, an effort to try to apply across the board in such a way that it deals with not just with me and my own particular group, but as much as possible deals with all of humanity. And finally, a claim about intelligibility, namely that any ethics that is truly deserving the name will find a way in which its concepts will be intelligible, will be able to be understood, will indeed seem reasonable and insightful. Now, for natural law theory, the stress on nature that is recurrent in this theory is the effort to provide an objective grounding for moral claims. It's not always easy to ascertain. It's not something that can be read off easily, but rather requires much reflection, much study, much generalization with all the appropriate cautions about generalization from empirical investigation. Nonetheless, it's a claim to find a certain objectivity for moral claims, a sense that one will find a fruitful source of information here for moral insight. This, I think, will be solid ground for natural law theory as long as the questions that we are asking, as long as the things that we are trying to settle on this basis, do still stand on that solid ground. Sometimes, I think, however, we get onto the ground that turns into cracking ice, cracking under our own weight, when the kind of uses that we are inclined to make are simply justifications of what we're used to, what we're comfortable with, what perhaps is customary in our society, or what may be habitual for us personally. At that point, we are no longer dealing with nature, but we're dealing with something which is idiosyncratic, which is personal, or perhaps familial, or maybe just cultural. And so merely the fact that a person claims that something is natural is not its own authentication or justification. But rather, what a natural law theory must do is to show that it is natural. And hence, we find ourselves locating the burden of argument always with the affirmative, locating the burden of argument with those who would claim that something or other is natural. Even the word nature has had many meanings in the course of history. The one that I prefer to use, and that I think is the mainstream tradition in natural law, is that sense of nature when we use the term to refer to an inner source of intelligibility, to an inner principle that makes a given being some kind of being. So one's human nature is that which makes us truly human, whereas those things which make us of one nationality, those things which make us of one religion or another, those things which make us a member of some voluntary group, are not natural in that sense. Those things are acquired. Those things are external. But rather, nature, in this strongly Aristotelian sense of the word, refers to those inner principles that are typical of a given kind of being, by which individuals who belong to that kind tend to grow so as to have a structure, both a bodily structure, a psychic structure, but also to have typical activities, things that we do as a matter of course and do because of our natures. Obviously, in the course of trying to appreciate this, it is a matter of long study, because frequently we can mistake merely what is customary or merely habitual, merely what we happen to be comfortable with. But when one looks more deeply and tries to analyze natures, one finds that those typical activities, the operations that are recurrent and present in all the members of the group or in most of the mature members of the group, and likewise those typical structures, the biological structures and the psychological structures, they lead us to another discovery that has been extremely important for the thinking on natural law, namely a discovery of the natural ends, the goals or purposes. And we saw in lecture after lecture from the very beginning of the course that this is to use a category, the notion of end or goal or purpose, which admittedly comes from human invention and human creativity. That when we are, for instance, sculptors, we have an end in our mind, an object of beauty or an object of some kind of representation that we want to make. The goal that we have directs the activities. But those goals and purposes, of course, are highly subjective. That is, they are very much a matter of what I have chosen to act upon, the reasons for which I have chosen to move or to do or to operate. What we're referring to here is the use of that category derived from choice, derived from freedom, derived from purposeful activity that has been chosen, and we apply that category to the realm of nature, asking whether or not there are not certain natural or intrinsic ends, certain goals. In the general sphere of biological nature, one finds that all the subsystems that are involved in a given organism contribute to the good of the organism, just as in the course of the development of that entity's life, that entity's existence, the early periods when the being is still immature move toward maturity, move toward that period when the being is a full, healthy, mature instance of the species. Obviously, many things can go wrong. There can be disease, there can be sickness, there can be illness, there can be accident or cross purposes. And yet, there is a natural development, a natural process. And for this reason, natural law thinkers are always inclined to say, we need to look at nature, but not to look at it in a frozen frame. We need to look at it rather and to respect the flow. And we need to try to ascertain what we can fairly claim as truly developmental, and on the other hand, what is something that is only idiosyncratic or typical of a small portion. This insight about final causality, that is, the kind of causality that an intrinsic goal or purpose has for an organism and for a specific kind within the natural world, joined with some analysis of the distinctive goals of human nature as personal nature allows us to have a full-blown natural law theory. What I mean by that last remark is that in addition to our biological goals, in addition to our psychic drives, there are things that are our ends precisely because we are persons, because we are beings capable of knowing and beings capable of deliberately choosing. There's matters of awareness and appreciation, but there are also matters of our loves and the deliberate decisions we make with respect to our loves. All of this requires that natural law ethics take into account in the course of trying to give a sense of human being, human existence, human values, and human institutions. In my judgment, then, those portions of the history of natural law that we were considering are most authentic and mainstream in natural law when there is not only ethics, but when there's a really solid anthropology, and behind that anthropology, a theory about how the being works, how the universe is. There are principles of metaphysics. On the other hand, we've also seen that the natural law tradition, as a very wide-ranging tradition, includes some theories of natural law which do not have a metaphysical component, which insist that there is a strong separation between theory and practice. And likewise, there are some portions of the natural law camp which only talk about human nature in terms of its biological and perhaps its psychic structure, but is extremely doubtful about whether human institutions can be included within the scope of that. And they would prefer to think of human institutions, whether families or perhaps at the larger level of societies, as things of human construction rather than of human nature. This is, I think, a good and honest ongoing debate within the tradition of natural law. All of this was said by way of objectivity. On that second criterion, namely the great concern that one has for universality, a philosophical approach to natural law tries to get beyond merely tribal loyalties, tries to get beyond simply privileged standpoints. It's the sort of thing which, in a religious ethics, one has a claim that one has a privileged standpoint. If one, for instance, is a follower of a revealed religion, if God has revealed his will, then one has a special standpoint. One has a privileged access. The claim made in natural law theory is that the only standpoint that one has is the standpoint of reason reflecting upon nature. And one asks and one tries to see how far and how broad one can, in fact, get one's ethical theory. It may be that it coheres with a religious point of view, but nonetheless that special privileged standpoint that revelation might provide isn't something that's an intrinsic part of natural law theory. It's something, rather, that might come to confirm it, or might come to challenge it, or might come, perhaps, simply to supplement it. But the claim here in philosophy is that we try to get, as much as possible, to a universal standpoint, that is, to look across the human history and to look across the human race to see what sort of things are indeed really perennial and valid, necessary causes, to see where the insights that are universally compelling or cogent, at least to a great probability, are. For this reason, natural law theory has always tried to balance concerns about the needs that specific individuals have in discrete and particular circumstances, with a concern for universal principles that apply always and across the board. It does so by being willing to distinguish between precepts that are really universal in character. Most of them are negative, things we cannot, may not do. It's sort of the silver rule, do not do unto others what we'd rather not have done to us. But there are also a number of positive commands, the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And in that golden rule, it's a matter of suggesting that in a given set of circumstances, one might have duties and that these duties are universally recognized, even though they are different and creative ways of fulfilling those duties. To use several examples, when one is thinking about what is bad or wrong for every member of the species, one can find on the basis of natural law that some things, for instance, the arbitrary taking of innocent human life, are regularly condemned by one culture after another. That is, that there's something wrong there. On the other hand, on the positive side, not everybody is in the position of having offspring immediately to hand. And yet there is a positive duty that can be recognized simply on the basis of our human nature, of our dependencies in the course of our childhood, so that we desperately need someone to help take care of our needs, and that this normally and usually falls upon parents, or if parents are unable to do so, or for some reason unwilling, that they still have an obligation to see to the care and raising of those offspring. In this respect, it is a matter of finding what is reasonable when we reflect upon human nature. It allows us to make relatively great progress about universalization, even in matters that are touching on things like politics. It allows us to say, for instance, that there is a positive case that can be made for political authority. Not that everything that the political authority decides is right, by no means, but rather that there is a legitimacy in the obedience that is in general expected to authority, precisely because the authority has an obligation to look out for the good of the whole, whereas individuals have to look out primarily for their own good and the good of their family. What implications this will have will be extremely varied depending on the creativity and the ways our societies have managed in trying to devise institutions which can carry out these natural duties. Again, let me take just one example. Capital punishment has always been a great subject for ethical discussion, precisely because it is such a tremendous and terrible punishment, a punishment from which there is no recourse. Many natural lawyers have argued that there is at least a natural correctness to capital punishment for certain capital crimes, precisely because the authority has an obligation to look for the safety of the community, and if that safety cannot be secured short of the death of criminals, those who have been convicted of crime, there is indeed a right on the part of the society to subject those criminals to capital punishment. On the other hand, one can have a legitimate debate about whether the public safety requires capital punishment if there are other means available to defend the society. Societies, for instance, which are stable enough to imprison individuals without threatening the public good and the public safety might well be excused from using such a severe punishment. So the natural law approach to this matter is to see what it is that is reasonable, reflecting upon our nature, reflecting not only on our particular nature, but on our social nature and our nature as in desperate need of various forms of association, and to try to establish what is reasonable, reasonable across the board as so far as possible universally, but with attentiveness to where circumstances and where conditions prevent us simply from saying one thing across the board, but perhaps articulating the range of permissible options, the range of alternatives that are possible given our other circumstances. In the natural law tradition, this quest for universality has usually led to a very fruitful distinction between negative precepts, those that apply always and everywhere, like that prohibition on murder, for instance, the prohibition on deliberately taking innocent human life, and those various positive precepts that apply only in certain circumstances, the obligation, for instance, to tell the truth, presuming that people with whom one is talking have a right to that truth, or the obligation to care for one's children if one has children. There's no sense that one must tell all the truth that one knows all the time, but rather that one must refrain from deliberately intending to deceive. Now, on the assumption that one only bears responsibility for that which one knows and that which one has chosen, natural law theory has often been concerned with talking about how one knows the natural law, and it tries to meet the third criterion, the criterion about intelligibility, by investigating how natural law is known. Sometimes it's known by teaching. This current venue that the teaching company offers a wonderful chance to do it in so many words and explicitly. And yet natural law is not thought to be dependent upon such formal teaching as this. Rather, the claim that natural law makes is that we have access, we have an ability to understand some of these natural law obligations even without such explicit teaching, and that the intelligibility of natural law comes by noticing two very interesting aspects of human existence. One is that we're filled with various kinds of inclination, that we're given in our very nature, we find given the various attractions and desires to good things, desires to good food, especially when we're hungry, desires to the refreshment of drink and the refreshment of sleep, attraction to members of the opposite sex, that we're having various kinds of attractions that are due to our animal nature, but also things that are due to our rational nature. Namely, we have a desire to know. We have a desire to express our affections. We have a desire to form friendships, especially friendships that will last. We have a desire to work together in community precisely because we like the sociability of others and because we desire some of the goods that are only possible with common participation, with a real contribution by many people, no one of which alone could manage those goods. That source of intelligibility, namely our own inclinations, is thought by natural law theory to be extremely important. It's a way to reflect on the fact that we know the natural law in our very bones, that we at least have a spontaneous and direct inclination toward these goods. And yet, merely to have an inclination doesn't by itself prove that anything is natural law. Here the problem is that as we find ourselves, we are products not just of nature, but also of nurture, that we have not only what is given, but we also have various histories, some of those histories being extremely helpful, other histories being frustrating, being in some way or other disordered. And hence, there is a need to reflect upon our various inclinations and to let reason try to test those inclinations to see which are indeed valid and legitimate and helpful, and which, on the other hand, need to be restrained, which need to be disciplined, which need to be dealt with ascetically or perhaps dealt with even heroically. Here, a second avenue of intelligibility surfaces, namely that for the sake of natural law, we invariably look at experience of other than our own. We look at the wise in our community. We look at the wise in our families. And we ask, what is it that really prospered them? Natural law always bears an enormous debt to history and to story, to the traditions of literature, as well as the formal traditions of recounting the deeds and the speeches that make up any of our national histories. As such, natural law theory is claiming that we can learn and understand what some of the obligations are by considering with our reasons what it is that is fruitful and what it is that is frustrating, and that this too is a source of intelligibility. I have emphasized and accentuated the role of reason in all this, precisely because the theories against which natural law sets itself over the course of history have tended to emphasize other factors. When, for instance, we are considering natural law as a theory of jurisprudence, when we are considering it in its influence upon the formation of society and the adjudication that is done by law, natural law theory stands in opposition to things like legal positivism and to ethical relativism. Invariably, systems such as these try to privilege the will as a source of moral value and to limit in one way or another intellect to a merely instrumental role, to a matter of figuring out how to obtain what we want, how to get what it is that we desire. But natural law tradition, in its mainstream approach, has always favored the priority of intellect to will. I mean this both for theological as well as for purely secular theories of natural law. Namely, it stresses a view of reason as deeply receptive. It's worthwhile thinking about this for a minute. Namely, that our powers of reason are such that they are first receptive and then active. That we must, if, for instance, we want to change some situation, maybe we don't like the way our society is presently organized, or maybe we don't like something in our own character or something in our own family. Any effort at change, any effort at the practical reason, when we're devising a solution, inventing a new structure, urging someone, or perhaps urging ourselves to take a new stand, requires first that we understand the way things are. Not that we'll keep things the way they are, but that we have to understand the way things are and why they are what they are. I consider this to be one of the chief virtues that is needed for a natural law approach. And it's the virtue of humility, a sense not of being the world's doormat, not humiliation, but humility in the sense, say, that Bernard of Clairvaux used to use it, namely as a reverent love for the truth, a truth about our nature, a truth about our common human nature, a truth about our social nature as well as our individual nature, and a truth that doesn't mind being challenged, that doesn't mind being investigated with all the tools that reason and philosophy can summon, precisely because the consequences and the stakes are so important. It is a matter of reflecting on those principles that are so basic that we cannot not know them, For instance, that we always should pursue the good and avoid the evil, but that we have to educate ourselves, inform ourselves about what is it that's good and what is it that's evil, because there are things that are merely apparently good, but are in fact not so good for us. They are inauthentic desires rather than authentic desires, and knowing the difference between the two is a project that requires enormous humility and a readiness to submit to interpersonal dialogue and criticism so that we aren't merely being comfortable with what we're used to. As such, the basic principles of natural law are in us as operating principles rather than as explicitly known, thematically stated, explicitly expressed propositions. When we come to a course like this, we try to state them in so many words. For example, that we should never do evil that good may come. But in us, it's an operating principle. In us, it's something that is innate or native to us, and that we need to learn how, over the course of time, by experience ourselves and by the consultation of the wise, we need to form our consciences in such a way that we regularly do this. On that subject, the theme of conscience is an extremely important subject within the tradition of natural law, and conscience is understood not as just, say, a Freudian superego. Conscience is understood not necessarily as a little voice, perhaps a voice of God or the voice of an angel, but rather conscience is understood, typically in natural law theory, as a power of our minds to judge, to evaluate actions we have done or actions we're considering doing in light of principles that we did not choose, in light of principles that are things that are already established by our nature, if we would only look carefully enough at that nature. I'm mindful, for instance, of the ways in which conscience needs to be better understood when I think of a wonderful popular movie and play. Perhaps you've seen at one point or another in your life Robert Bolt's A Man for All Seasons. And it's a tremendous play about a great hero of mine, Thomas Moore. But the one reservation I have about the presentation of Thomas Moore in that particular piece of stagecraft is the way in which conscience is portrayed. Moore is made to say, at various points in the course of the play, that he has been faithful to his conscience, faithful to his set of chosen principles. And I think that that probably does a bit of disservice to Thomas Moore as well as to the notion of conscience. Not that conscience shouldn't mean fidelity to one's principles, for that is exactly what conscience means. My quibble is with the notion that it is fidelity to one's chosen principles. For I think that what Thomas Moore himself stood for were principles that he did not choose, principles that instead that he found already in practice, in operation, and things which he could not, in truth, deny. So too, I think, with respect to us, what adequate formation of conscience means is a training in a fidelity to principles, such as principles about what fosters and fulfills human nature, and the avoidance of what it is that frustrates human nature, and standing fast, standing steadfast for those principles that we did not choose, but which are already present as operating principles of our nature. Coming, of course, to understand these things, to articulate them, to really grasp them and to let them be useful, does require the mediation of various authorities in our lives, parents, the wise, perhaps clergy, perhaps teachers. All of these authorities consulted and needing to be personally accepted, needed to be personally regulated in our life, and that we do this precisely as we mature under the careful guidance of some natural structures such as the family. Now, with this in mind, the objectivity, the universality, the intelligibility, natural law theory has often been invoked by thinkers, political and social. It has been invoked sometimes for very conservative purposes to maintain order, sometimes for very radical and revolutionary purposes in founding and in refounding and in revising and reforming various structures. In the course of natural law's history, there has been a sense, though, that whether it be used for things new or for the maintenance of things old, what we must look at are principles of right and justice that have prevailed by reason of their intrinsic excellence, that are true regardless of whether those in possession of power are willing to recognize them. It is in this sense that we can talk, for instance, about inalienable rights in our own Declaration of Independence, or that we can criticize certain practices in our own culture's history, such as slavery, in which these inalienable rights, in which these native principles of justice were somehow ignored, that somehow the culture was blind to them. It allows us to make judgments which are not demeaning, but which attempt to be appreciative of what this basic human nature is. It has allowed the practice of judicial review to flourish in our society, but even that, too, can be abused. Rather, what natural law tries to do as a theory is to invoke principles of right and justice that remain the same and abide in our nature, and to try to find ways to institutionalize them. We do so in government, we do so in forms of voluntary association, we do so in family, and we need to do so in the formation of our own character. Thank you for this opportunity to talk with you about the natural law. It gives us the venue for the discussion of many other interesting moral and social topics in our own day.
We genuinely hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.